Due to a technical issue that arose between recording the proper episode this week and our mic check, I'm afraid our audio quality in this episode is diminished from the normal. We should be back up and running by next week, since I'm able to record this now, but I just wanted to give you a heads up. Thank you for your patience as we deal with this issue, and sorry about this episode. Thank you very much. Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slidekick.
Yarr!
Today is December 18th, 2016, and this is episode 127, The Beating of a Million Drums. Civilization turns 25. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're talking about our favorite 4X strategy sim, Civilization. So buckle in and get ready for that. But first, we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Slaggy, do you want to get us started?
Yes, we have our first tease at what the Super Nintendo World in Universal Studios Japan could look like. There's been some art release, and I am super hyped. The artwork has, like, Peach's Castle, like, Super Mario 3D worldy platforms, a Bowser Castle, and I mean, that's just the art, so it is actually happening, our dreams are coming true, and obviously it's still a ways off. The Osaka Park is not going to open until 2020, and I don't anticipate that the Hollywood or Orlando
It'll be open before the 2020 Olympics. Strictly speaking,
yeah.
We don't know exactly when in that window, but it will be before that time.
That's true, so I don't expect that we'll see it in Hollywood or Orlando quite that early, but you never know. Either way, it's super exciting, and I'm going to make a Mario sort of Nintendo World in Planet Coaster now.
That is awesome.
We should do that.
Yeah, you know, I actually saw in GAF some people were starting to create like UI, not UI elements, but like in-game assets for people to download through the Steamworks shop.
That's so awesome.
So that you can build Mario Super Land or whatever. So definitely some exciting stuff. In other exciting Mario news, we also have word here that Super Mario Run, within its first day of release, hit the number one most downloaded game, or actually most downloaded app, in 62 countries. In addition to that, it's also the top grossing app in the United States, as well as Germany, the Netherlands, Mexico, Guatemala, and Colombia.
Oh, wow, that means a lot of people are actually paying for the full game then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to talk about this a little bit when we talk about what we've been playing this week, but I'm super impressed by this title, and I think it's absolutely worth the purchase.
Well, it's not me, Tomo. So Pokemon Sun and Moon has had the best release in the franchise's history and has boosted sales of the 3DS. The Sun and Moon releases, even though they were out for fewer days, beat out Black and White by 8% more units, and compared to November a year ago, a 59% growth of 3DS hardware sales.
Holy moly.
Yeah, I mean, those games are amazing. I already can't wait to play Sun, even though I just beat Moon, you know, a month ago. So good and well-deserved. Unfortunately, Dreams from Media Molecule has been delayed. They will give more updates in 2017. They basically do not want to release it or, you know, show too much of it until there's no bugs and features that there are missing and such. So,
well, and this is interesting because we were expecting by this point to have already played the beta for the game, so...
Yeah. I guess when one of Sony's super hyped games releases with a bunch of content missing, that's what happens.
Pretty much. We also have word here that select cities in North America will be hosting the Nintendo Switch Preview Tour. This is going to be beginning on January 13th, 2017 in New York. That is, of course, the day after the Nintendo Switch Presentation 2017 event that'll be happening on January 12th, obviously. After that point, it will be appearing in a handful of cities. It's going to be in each city for 3 days. The first 2 days will be invitation only for, like, media media and social media influencers. Unfortunately, we did not make the cut for that. We did not get an invite, even though I tweeted at Nintendo begging, LOL. But the third day will be open to the public at each event. Space is going to be limited. Opportunities will be offered to play on a first-come, first-served basis. They are allowing and encouraging social media posts, pictures to be posted. So this is very much a word-of-mouth building type event. It's going to be in New York the 13th to the 15th of January. It'll be in Toronto January 27th to 29th, Washington, D.C., February 10th to 12th, Chicago, Illinois, February 17th to 19th, February 24th to the 26th in San Francisco, and March 3rd to 5th in Los Angeles.
You ready to camp out on the streets of San Francisco, Captain Spike?
I'm a little bit afraid of the venereal diseases we'll get, but sure.
Really, of all the things to be worried about camping out on a San Francisco street, and you're worried about venereal diseases.
I'm a practical man. We also have word here that Final Fantasy XV's Holiday Pack DLC and new update will be releasing in Japan on December 22nd. It does look as if we will be getting this worldwide around that same date. It's going to include such things as New Game Plus, social media photo frames for your shared photos that Prompto takes, the Final Fantasy 15 Holiday Pack Plus, which is available to those who have the season pass, will also get a protection ring, the command booster ring, the phantom booster, the instant kill victory song, the battle skill victory song, the key of fortune, the stamina anchor, the carnival style photo frame, and the limited time carnival ticket, which will lead you to a handful of seasonal mini games. So it's some exciting stuff coming along for Final Fantasy fans.
I better get that season pass before this hits.
Right? We also have word that Final Fantasy Type-0 Online, this is of course the mobile social like multiplayer game that we knew was coming at some point this year in China, is now released in beta as Final Fantasy Awakening. This game is being structured as an MMO smartphone action game. Last we heard, it is being considered for release in North America and Europe, Japan, so fingers crossed that we do see that happen.
So we have the Xbox 360 Marketplace release of Lost Odyssey and Blue Dragon.
Yeah, this is really exciting. You may recall, of course, that these two games joined backwards compatibility earlier this year, but that was for disc owners of these games. You were not able to download the games from the 360 Marketplace. As of this week, that is no longer the case, and even more fun for people who buy it from the shop this before December 31st, Lost Odyssey is a free download.
So that has nothing to do with Games for Gold then?
No, it doesn't. It is just a free download. It is a promotion to celebrate the one-year anniversary of the Xbox One backwards compatibility program.
Or when Xbox One got its groove back.
All right. We also have word here that Valkyria Azure Revolution is heading to North America as Valkyria Revolution. This is, of course...
No Azure for you.
Right? This is very exciting. We really look forward to getting to play this game in English. And I think it's really exciting that it's going to be releasing in North America on PS4, PS Vita, and Xbox One.
Oh, nice.
It's going to be available physically and digitally for the consoles, but the Vita version will be a PSN exclusive.
Do you blame them?
You know, I don't, but I think it's really cool that they are allowing that option for Vita owners.
Yeah.
We also have word here of the official time that the Nintendo Switch presentation will be taking place. That is going to be on January 12th at 8 p.m. Pacific.
I almost feel like we need to have like a Switch dinner party.
You know, what we will very likely do, you, me, and anyone else who's at the SS Game Buoy that night, probably do a dinner party and watch it, and then do a live stream episode immediately after.
Well, that is a Thursday, I believe.
Yeah, and that'll be difficult for you to schedule, but nut up and do it.
So, Tekken 7 has added Kuma and Panda, two of your favorite bears.
Yeah,
I guess. And also an online tournament mode for console.
Yeah, you know, this is really exciting. Obviously, Tekken 7's home console release is something that a lot of people have been looking very much forward to. We are finally nearing that early 2017 release window. And it's cool to see these fan favorite bears get added back to the game.
They're really cute.
Indeed. We also have word here that last week, a couple of our favorite games were added to the Virtual Console for Wii U and 3DS. On the Wii U, we have Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon and Metroid Other M. Metroid Other M, of course, is the controversial Nintendo Wii release in the much-storied franchise. Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon, however, is the remake of the very first Fire Emblem game, originally appearing on the Nintendo DS.
Oh, yeah.
Shadow Dragon originally appeared on the Nintendo DS, not the first Fire Emblem, games, obviously, so that we're clear. This is one of those games that on cartridge is like really hard to find, super rare, so this is really exciting stuff
just
to be able to get it so easily.
Just plop down $10 on your Wii U.
Yeah, absolutely. And last but not least is the 3DS Virtual Console release of Demon's Crest.
New Nintendo 3DS.
New Nintendo 3DS, quite right. And this is, of course, the Super Nintendo sequel to the Gargoyle's Quest series.
I'm like, do you really have to explain Demon's Crest on Game Buoy?
I would think not. I talk about this game all the time. It's my favorite game of all time. And really excited that, you know, people who maybe haven't had the opportunity to play it for before will have the opportunity now.
How many times have you played through it since it popped on the eShop?
Since it popped on the eShop on new 3DS? Only once this week.
But you played through it all the way.
Of course. It's been out for like a week. How could I not have?
All right, so Hajime Tabata-san, the director of Final Fantasy XV, has given an update roadmap, I don't know if pun intended, for Final Fantasy XV. I am not at this point in the game yet, but apparently, from what I've heard, Chapter 13 is very drama. So their first short-term goal is to increase the degree of gameplay satisfaction for Chapter 13 and providing a major power-up for rain magic and such. Then they're also going to be adding some cutscenes to kind of smooth over some of the story things, elements and such that apparently people were not happy with. And they eventually want to make other characters playable and have an avatar system to make your own original character to play the game.
Yeah, you know, there's some really exciting stuff here. I'm a big fan of Final Fantasy XV, obviously, but when I was finishing the game, and I may talk about this a little bit later, I did really dislike Chapter 13. I did not think it was well designed. I thought that the things that they did achieve in it could have been done much better otherwise. Like literally, the whole game changes the way you play it for that chapter, and it's just unfun, poorly designed, poorly communicated. I haven't talked to a single person who was like, oh, I enjoyed that chapter.
I mean, I've
that's
seen people on social media being like, that ruined the game for them, they don't like it, and they won't play it again.
Yeah, oh, you know, I'm not surprised. I would rather never play that chapter again myself. I probably will at some point, but I would prefer not to.
So, we will keep you posted on Final Fantasy XV stuff.
Indeed. We also got word right after we recorded. In fact, did we make mention of this last episode? Because I feel like word broke literally like 2 hours after we recorded.
Yeah, I feel like it was after when we were winding down for the evening and we were like, oh.
Yeah, and that is word that Morrigan and Captain America are also going to be characters in Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite. This is, of course, super exciting. Morrigan and Captain America are both well-loved characters in these versus games, and we are super excited for Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite. I would expect to hear updates on GameBuoy.org about every character that gets announced for this game, so please look forward to it.
So, for fans of Age of Empires, or Age of Empires 2 specifically, there's going to be a new expansion. This is, of course, for Age of Empires 2 HD. This is called Age of Empires 2 HD Rise of the Rajas. It is not surprisingly about pet tigers of Princess Jasmine, but it is about the four major Southeast Asian civilizations, the Burmese, Khmer, Malay, and Vietnamese, and I'm sorry if I butchered any of those.
What I think is really cool is this is actually the third expansion released for this game. Several of these expansions have been like 20 years after the original release of the game, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it just goes to show that people love these games a lot.
Do you have Age of Empires 2 HD?
I don't know. I'd have to check my Steam.
You should. If you don't, let me know. I think I have an extra key because I actually bought a 4-pack of that.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. We also have word here of the Soul Calibur Anniversary release. This is a pachinko game. Soul Calibur patchy slot.
Are you sure you didn't say Konami?
No, this is Bandai Namco. However, before you get too upset, worried that, you know, this is, you know, going full Metal Gear, it is worth mention that all of the people behind Soul Calibur have talked about wanting to do a game after, like, the Tekken 7 wave and, like, once the timing is right. So, I'm actually excited for this. I'll be in Japan when this is in parlors, so...
Oh, cool.
I kind of want to check it out. That having been said, you know, I'm only okay with it because we do expect there to be a proper Soul Calibur, like, 7 or whatever.
Well,
down the line. What?
I'm just saying, well. Oh, apparently I have not only Age of Empires 2 HD, but also Age of Empires 3 Complete Collection.
Excellent, although I'd rather play 2 than 3, so. We also have word here that World of Final Fantasy, which is, of course, a delightful little gem of a game, is getting the upcoming patch 1.02, which is going to bring proper PS4 Pro support. and some new additional features to the game. There was an interesting glitch when you played World of Final Fantasy on a PlayStation 4 with, like, the higher resolution and everything, that the actual, like, graphics renderer would F up, and it would apply depth of field effect across the entire game screen, so everything was just blurry and fuzzy and gross. So they will be fixing that. They're going to be adding a theater mode to the title menu, so you can watch, like, all of the event scenes and cutscenes. You'll be getting they're adding some feedback on the mysterious switch so that it's a little easier to track whether it's been flipped or not. And they're also going to be changing the way the game communicates the vestiges of life side quest so that, you know, you have a little bit of an easier way to track where you're at on that. Overall, these are some really fantastic quality of life changes for the game. And on this same day, we're also getting a new champion summon via DLC. This is Chibi Sora.
Aww.
Yeah, so he looks cute as a button. I'm super excited to have Sora in this game. I cannot wait for that summon to come up. Fantastic promo for Kingdom Hearts HD 2.8 Final Chapter Prologue, which is releasing in Japan on the same day. And he'll only be available as a free download until March 31st. So please look forward to it. And if you have World of Final Fantasy, I would recommend you hop on it in that time window. If you don't have World of Final Fantasy, maybe consider getting it.
All right. So Square Enix has shown more of Dragon Quest XI at Jump Festa 2017.
And that's actually just this weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so this is fresh off the press. So they talked a little bit about how, you know, they're developing it for the three platforms, PS4, 3DS, and Switch, and that, you know, they're kind of doing different features for each. So the 3DS will have a Street Pass function, but since the PS4 version does not have Street Pass, they're preparing something else for it. We got a look at the ally of the protagonist, and I guess was this the first time they showed the protagonist too?
I believe so.
So kind of looking just like an Android 17 kind of guy, and then he's got a blue spiky-haired bro.
Well, and something interesting is that, you know, a lot of Japanese fans have noted the new ally Camus, who is the spiky blue-haired bro, looks more like a traditional main character than the actual main characters in the game. So definitely some interesting stuff going on here that sort of breaks from the traditions of Dragon Quest design.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. We also have word here that Shantae Half Genie Heroes release date is going to be December 20th, 2016.
By
the time you're hearing this, you will finally be playing the newest, well-loved Shantae game. Fate Extella will be releasing in North America on January 17th, 2017. Yooka-Laylee will be releasing on April 11th, 2017.
But not on Wii U.
But not on Wii U, unfortunately. The Wii U version has been canceled. Apparently,
can you blame them,
the folks over at Playtonic Games actually were trying for months, and they've actually done several interviews to this effect since this announcement was made a week or two ago. Basically, they were working for months trying to get the game running acceptably on the Wii U, and they were unfortunately completely unable to do that. However, they are working closely with Nintendo to bring Yooka-Laylee to the Nintendo Switch, saying that they will have more details regarding these developments, quote-unquote, early next year. There has been some buzz on the internet that though we aren't getting a release date for the Switch version, we may have a release date at that January 12th event. So, fingers crossed that they have been working closely enough with Nintendo to have it releasing on Switch on that same April 11th date. We will see.
Right.
We also have word that Knights of Azure and Atelier Sophie will be releasing on PC via Steam on February 7th, 2017. Dragon Quest Heroes will be releasing in North America on the PlayStation 4 on April 25th, 2017. Unfortunately, the Vita version of Dragon Quest Heroes 2 will not be coming to North America. Nier Automata will be getting a PS4 demo in Japan on December 22nd. I bring that up here because I know a lot of you have made Japanese PSN accounts so that you can download stuff like this. I definitely have, and I will be taking advantage of this on the 22nd. I really want to see what this game's combat is like. I imagine a lot of y'all out there wonder too.
Yeah, it looks super good.
Grasshopper Manufacture's early masterpiece, The Silver Case, will be releasing in North America on PlayStation 4 on April 18th. Axel World vs. Sword Art Online will be releasing in Japan on March 16th, 2017 on PlayStation 4 and PlayStation Vita. Sayonara Box Boy is the third Box Boy game. It will be releasing on the Nintendo 3DS in Japan on February 2nd, 2017.
I wonder if it'll be localized as Bye Bye Box Boy.
I expect it will. And last but definitely not least, we have word that The Binding of Isaac Afterbirth Plus will be releasing on Steam on January January 3rd. This DLC will include mod support and new items, bosses, and rooms, with console versions coming in the spring. And, as it has been heavily rumored, we also expect it to be releasing in the spring on the Nintendo Switch.
Man, it's just really interesting to see Binding of Isaac grow from the, you know, this little indie title into a big thingy.
It sure has. So, with all of that having been said, it is time for some...
News. Oh my god. News. OMG. News.
Yeah. You want to take this one?
Sure. Also at the Jump Festa 2017, which I guess they do for the Jump Festas are named for the year that's coming, I guess. I was like, wait, it's not 2017 yet.
That is correct.
Unfortunately, Koei Tecmo has announced Dynasty Warriors 9 for an unrevealed platform, so we don't know what it is yet, but it's going to be more of an open world title, so that's interesting. They are trying to make their aim is to make all of China's continent into one giant map. Although, I mean, China isn't really a continent, but do they mean like the Asian mainland continent? I don't know.
I assume they do, and what's interesting about this is that it's going to be like open world. That's going to be such a big change for the franchise.
Right.
You know, it's already so focused on like very heavily regimented play fields and stuff, so definitely some interesting stuff going on here. I'm really excited to see what they do with this.
Yeah, this is an anniversary title, isn't it?
I believe it is, yeah.
Yeah, it's the 15th anniversary.
Wow. We also have word here that at least in Japan, Capcom is going to be releasing the first 6 of the mainline Mega Man titles on smartphone. That's coming January 6, 2017. It'll be Mega Man 1 through 6, and it's going to have such features as auto shot, automatic charges for your charge shots, as well as new functions such as game speed. So,
interesting.
It's going to be weird and hopefully good.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
We also have word here that Kankole Kai for PS Vita is ending all shipment and sales in Japan by the end of January 2017. This is, of course, kind of weird for this series. You know, it's well-liked by a certain segment of gamers, especially in Japan. Just interesting to see them taking it off shelves via retail and digital completely. Like, super strange.
Ooh, even Siri was interested in that.
Oh, yeah, my phone just made a little beep-beep. Y'all probably didn't hear it, but...
I noticed, I was like, oh, Siri is looking into that.
Yeah, Siri believes I said, hey Siri, is it out its Wi-Fi certain segment of gamers, especially Japan? To which Siri simply said, interesting question, Spike.
Alright. So we have a bunch of information coming out from the Forward Works event, which is Sony Interactive Entertainment smartphone company. And
yep.
one of the first announcements is that Disgaea and Yomiwari from Nipponichi Software are headed to smartphone.
That is awesome. You know, we're big fans of Disgaea. Kind of enjoyed Yomiwari, but I haven't finished it. So definitely exciting to see these games coming to the smartphone platform. We also have word here that the new title from Sakura Taisen creator Oji Hiroi, Sora to Umi no Aida, Between Sky and Sea, will be published via Sony Interactive Entertainment's smartphone division for smartphone.
I'd be surprised if it was published by the smartphone division for something that's not a smartphone.
Fair. We also got the announcement of Sony's Project Field. This is going to be a kind of interesting, like, new way to bring card games, like physical trading card games, to the digital world, sort of in the style of, like, what we saw them do with Eye of Judgment. Eye of Judgment, yeah. But this has a whole lot more, like, gear involved to it. It has, like, these weird little pads that I guess use NFC chips in the cards in order to, like, tell what cards you have in play and like whether they're like tapped out like in a side orientation or not. It looks like some weird stuff, but the first game that's going to be available for this platform is actually a Yo-Kai Watch game, so that's definitely very interesting stuff. We also have word that Doko Demo Ishio, Parappa the Rapper, and Boku no Natsu Yasumi are going to be released on smartphone in Japan.
Wow.
I'm particularly excited about this because I've talked here on the show about how, you know, mobile and handheld devices, I think, are best for rhythm games. Particularly, Parappa the Rapper is a game where the PS1 version, if you play it on, like, a PS3 on your HDTV, is unplayable because of lag issues and stuff.
I mean, that's why this PS4 64 HD version is such a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, playing it, I kind of feel like they probably just loosened the timing window requirements, because I still didn't feel like I was doing notably better than I did the last time I tried to play it on an actual disc on PS3.
Yeah.
But I still got scored better, so...
Yeah.
We also have word that mobile phones via this same publisher will be getting a version of Hot Shots Golf in the spring in Japan. No Heroes Allowed Dash will be coming to Japanese smartphones in the summer of 2017. Ark the Lad will be getting a new game on smartphone that will be both a reboot and a new story in the series. And Wild Arms will be getting a brand new game for smartphone featuring classic heroes from previous games in the series.
Oh, wow.
Indeed. So definitely some very exciting stuff happening on smartphones, courtesy of Sony. A lot of fan favorite brands making comeback. What do you think about this slate? Are you excited about any of these games, Slaggy?
I mean, you know, I traditionally don't follow smartphone gaming that heavily, but I mean, it's interesting that they, you know, had enough notable announcements to have a special event to reveal them all.
Indeed. It's interesting that, you know, this set of announcements came a week before Super Mario Run released. Super Mario Run, of course, is sort of rewriting the books on how you can do all of this. So definitely exciting stuff happening right now. Moving on, though, we do have some pieces of news for you in the Culture Club segment. This is, of course, where we talk about stories that, you know, aren't quite news, but are primarily notable to the gaming audience. The first one we have here is word from Shigeru Miyamoto-san, who states that he would like to further develop franchises such as Pikmin and Star Fox. This is, of course, notable that a lot of people who like Star Fox feel that Nintendo has never given the series a fair shot since the days of the Nintendo 64. While I beg to differ, I think it's exciting to see Miyamoto-san openly stating he is not done with that franchise. He specifically has always wanted Fox McCloud as a character to achieve more popularity than he has, as Pikmin.
I'm like, is he aware of certain aspects of the fandom that are very enthusiastic for Fox?
He probably is, and he probably wishes he wasn't. So, you know, previously, Nintendo has spoken about the upcoming 3DS release Miitopia as a Japanese exclusive, but in one of the recent updates of Miitomo, new loading screens with, you know, cute, like, suggestions and guidances were released, and one of these loading screens mentions Miitopia for Nintendo 3DS.
Interesting.
So, you know, it seems like a simple thing, but this is the first time Nintendo, in any of their official press, has mentioned the game in English. It doesn't confirm a localization, of course, but it has given a lot of gamers hope that we will be seeing a Miitopia release at some point.
Something kind of cute that happened recently is that some players and fans of Overwatch got together on the Overwatch subreddit started out as a Indiegogo project called the Blizzard Cookies Project, and then the Overwatch Reddit found out and were able to raise, as of this recording time, $2,891.
For cookies.
For cookies for Blizzard. So the organizer of the Indiegogo campaign is in contact with Blizzard to try to get a catering company to get, at this point, almost $3,000 of cookies for Blizzard as a way to thank them for the hard work they put in for Overwatch.
Well, and to thank them for cute little things like in the recent Overwatch holiday update, having you know, a canon nod to the sort of romance between Junkrat and Roadhog.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Roadhog's gun in the holiday update has a little sticker on it that says "from Junkrat," and a lot of people are taking that as like, oh, it's confirmed they're lovers.
I mean, or they could just.
There's also cute screens of them like in like shorts, like Hawaiian holiday vacation style, like leaning next to each other on like recliners, like outdoor recliners. So a lot of people feel like it's being hinted at.
I would totally be happy for that, but they could also just be buddies.
It's true. I mean, buddies who holiday in Hawaii together.
I mean, well, we know what happened with Red and Blue when they decided to holiday in Alola together.
Yeah, people made the same assumption. So, this week, a ton of Nintendo Switch patents have surfaced online. This is, of course, a very exciting time because we start to get some information on, like, how the leaks relate to what is actually patented for release. Obviously, you know, we now know for sure that the USB-C port on the bottom of the system is what's going to be used to both charge the device as well as to connect to the dock to connect to your TV. We also see that there will be a micro SD slot on the console, so there will be expandable memory for your downloads and stuff on the handheld version. There are also patents to show a head-mounted display peripheral for the Switch, which the Switch would, just slot into without the Joy-Cons attached to the side. It's actually the perfect form factor for this, but interestingly enough, we may end up with VR support on the Nintendo Switch, which is very exciting.
Hey, it could happen.
We also have word via these patents that the Joy-Con controllers do support both motion control and support rumble. As well as that, we see signs of the IR sensor on the Joy-Cons. So we also have, the Switch in this patent has a share button on the bottom of the left Joy-Con, and it's referred to in the patent as a record button. So we definitely have some very exciting stuff here. A lot of the rumors that have been previously reported being confirmed, just very exciting stuff here as far as, really finally getting a sense of what the Switch is really going to be like to play on.
Oh man, if we could be, it would be interesting to think how that would work as far as the record. Like, because what if we were playing a multiplayer game over here at the SS Buoy with our Switches, and we were like both broadcasting to our own Twitch channels or something? Or would I don't know. Like,
why would that be any different than two people playing Overwatch and streaming to Twitch?
I guess it wouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think it would be, and I think it'd be really cool. And I think hopefully we'll get some stuff like that going on.
Yeah.
And last, and probably not least, unfortunately,
doomy and gloomy kind of.
Yeah. And I mainly wanted to sort of talk about this. We have word from Kotaku again that, much like happened around this time last year, Crytek employees say that they are not getting paid.
Ooh.
Specifically, they have apparently been getting paid either not at all or late for most of the year, but that they're now getting to the point that, like, for a lot of these people, they haven't seen money since, like, August, basically.
Oh, my God.
We have word that, some of the artists are, like, filing suits against Crytek now. This is, like, a big deal.
I mean, I can't even imagine.
Part of why I wanted to talk about this as a part of Culture Club, though, is that I still, to this day, see word from people online, that Kotaku is trash. They want to talk about stuff that Kotaku is reporting on, but they don't want to link to Kotaku because they hate it. But in a very real way, Kotaku is doing the most to bring stuff like this to light, to give voice to, like, the actual workers in gaming, to, like, make sure that they're treated right, that we know what's going on with them so that we could potentially help them, boycott product by publishers that are doing this sort of thing. I don't know. For me, Kotaku is actually providing a service here. They have a support, like a anonymous support line that is open to people in the industry who need to talk about these things under the, cover of anonymity for the sake of protecting their job. No one else is giving these people voices. For all the problems we have had with Kotaku, and I think we've been pretty open about the fact that we've had problems with them in the past, but we feel they have addressed most of them.
But I mean,
they are doing in this regard is something that this industry deeply needs and is not being provided anywhere else.
You think about it, we're coming up on 5 years of Buoy, and, Kotaku's in a lot of ways a very different site than it was 5 years ago.
Oh, I would argue it's a completely different site. It's practically the same in name only at this point.
And, for all the other sites that are like, blah, 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 industry, and, that have industry connections, I mean, I feel like Kotaku's really the one that is most concerned about, like, the state of the industry and the culture of the industry, so...
I would agree with that statement.
And just, like, I still feel like maybe aside from things like Waypoint now, or things like Boing Boing, what's the...
It seems a little premature to include Waypoint since it's only a month old, but I am very into what they're doing. I'm sorry, continue.
And then what is it on Boing Boing? Offworld?
I believe so.
Aside from those, really the only ones that really feel like they are a voice of, representing, like, what the community is doing. Like, I think of articles like Gita Jackson reporting about Insta Sims pregnancy, teen pregnancies and stuff. It's like, these are interesting things happening in the, the hobby that we partake in, the lifestyle, the community, and, all these types of sites are the only ones really giving you that sort of content.
Absolutely. All right, well, with all that having been said, let's move on to our discussion. We're, of course, talking about Civilization. Civilization is a series of turn-based strategy games, first released in 1991. We're going to be relying heavily on Wiki here for this first bit, and I want to obviously credit them. Something that we struggle with a little bit here is talking about the actual, like, entry-level gameplay of games sometimes. we get so caught up in our discussions of, like, advanced mechanics and emergent gameplay that I think we sometimes miss, like, the basic description. So I'm just copying from Wiki here. I think that that'll get it done best. All of the titles in Civilization sort of share similar gameplay. They're sort of centered on the idea of building a civilization from a macro scale from prehistory up to the near future.
You don't say.
Each turn allows the player to move his or her units on the map and build or improve new cities and units, as well as initiate negotiations with player-controlled characters and, obviously, other players in the game. In between turns, computer players or other human players can do the same. The player will also choose technologies to research, which reflect the cultural, intellectual, and technical sophistication of the civilization, and usually allow the player to build new units or to improve their cities with new structures. In most games in the series, one may win by military conquest, achieving a certain level of culture, building an interstellar spaceship, or achieving the highest score. So what that really means, and Saigi, obviously you can chime in if you choose, the core gameplay loop of Civilization is, you know, it's a turn-based game, later iterations of the game, multiplayer, you're playing online with people, taking your turn simultaneously. Every turn, you know, you start off with just a couple of units. Typically one has the ability to form a city, the other is sort of meant to explore the map and find resources on the map for you. And basically you start from making that city with your first unit. You want to start investing in new units, new tile improvements, so that your city can generate more resources faster. And basically, the entire game is sort of a strategic balancing act between producing new units, new resources, and investigating and exploring, you know, the world map and new resources and new units.
Yeah, that's actually, for a game that, Civilization is a game that is kind of hard to explain until you've really experienced it, but I think that's a pretty good summary.
All right. Obviously, Sid Meier developed the first game in the series. He has had creative input for most of the other iterations. And the result of that, of course, is that his name is usually included in the formal title for these games. Obviously, he was at MicroProse when he first started the Civilization series. There was a studio that he co-founded. After it was acquired by Spectrum Holobyte, he actually left and formed Firaxis Games back in 1996.
Probably best because we know what happened to MicroProse.
Right. Obviously, you know, the Firaxis Games folks have had a hand in quite a few extremely successful strategy games of their own. Age of Empires, Rise of Nations, Spore. Some of those people actually also worked with the Civilization brand for the Civilization board game back in the 80s. And actually, it's now currently owned Firaxis by Take-Two. They own full rights to both the name Civilization and the intellectual property of the series. As of last month, the series has shipped more than 37 million total units, which for a series that has largely been a PC exclusive with a few asides, which we will discuss today, that's a big-ass number.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of these games themselves. Slaggy, would you like to get us started with Civilization 1?
Yeah, so Civ 1 is the first Civ game, as you can guess, and it was released in 1991 for a variety of PC platforms because, you know, this was back before we just had basically PC, Mac, Linux, or is it Linux? I never know.
Linux.
So it was released for DOS, Windows, Amiga, Macintosh, Atari ST. Later got releases for the Sega Saturn, Super NES, PlayStation, and N-Gage.
And I want to be clear here. I actually got my Civ introduction with the SNES port of Civilization.
Interesting.
It actually supported the Mario Paint mouse.
Oh, that must have helped.
Yeah, so playing it on Super Nintendo back then with the mouse, it was not that different from playing it on the PC, or at least that's my memory of it. But continue.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the game of Civilization originally was a board game, and I actually didn't know that until we were researching, you know, we decided to have this discussion topic, and, you know, I was researching on some of the earlier history. So when Sid Meier kind of took hold of this, because his idea was kind of based on the board game of Risk, which, you know, I guess you can kind of see some similarities there. And so I haven't personally played this one, but, you know, it had the core elements of you are playing as one of the rulers of an ancient civilization, or not necessarily ancient, but, you know, a historical civilization, and, you know, exploring the map, and fighting off barbarians, and from what I'm familiar with, there's not too much difference in which civilization you choose, aside from kind of like a cosmetic appearance, which, you know, would affect the names of your cities, and also if you're playing on the real Earth map, so that's definitely something that's different with the more recent Civ games, where, you know, if you're playing AI against the AI, the other Civs definitely have, you know, their own quirks and such.
And, you know, I do want to take a side note. Civilization, the video game, is not strictly speaking based on the Civilization board game, but this has been some matter of dispute over the years. Sid Meier claims that he did not play the original board game before making the PC game. He states that he was primarily inspired by SimCity, Railroad Tycoon, and Risk, as Slaggy had mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, the name of the computer game, it wasn't even originally locked in as Civilization, but they actually acquired the rights to use the name from Avalon Hill back in the day. So, you know, just wanted to point out, you know, when we talk about Civilization and talk about the board game, especially interestingly, because the board game did have a tech tree, and it's generally considered the first game ever, board or video game, to have a tech tree. As I understand it, you can still get, like, editions of it, but we'll talk about that later. You and I, off air, I mean.
Right.
I just wanted to note, you know, sort of that crowbar separation here, that we haven't brought up the board game a ton, and we will not be doing it a ton, because we are going to sort of follow in line with Sid Meier's statements that the game was not based on the board game.
Thank you for that.
Of course.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look back at, you know, Civ 1, definitely, like, visually, you know, it's very primitive compared to this, if you're familiar with modern Civs, but I mean,
at, like, the time, it was kind of a looker, though.
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, like, the Amiga version, like, if you look at screenshots of the Amiga version, it's pretty nice. I can't speak to the other ones.
Yeah, I mean, just compared to what a lot of, like, DOS-based games looked like back then, it still looks basic, but it's, I don't know, it's cool. You said you haven't played this game?
No, and I don't think this one's even available in Steam, as far as I know.
I believe you're correct. Funny enough, the easiest way to play this in the modern age would probably be just, like, emulating the SNES version?
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, I know they have Free Civ, which is the open-source Civ.
Yeah, is that still being updated?
I'm not sure.
You know what? I just loaded up the Free Civ Wikipedia, and it looks like the most recent release was November 20th, 2016.
Oh, wow.
And funny enough, looking at it graphically, it looks very different from, like, modern Civ, but it actually looks kind of good.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Anyway.
Very Windows 95.
Well, yeah. Continue.
Yeah, I mean, so that's about as much as I could offer for, you know, Civ 1. Like I said, I had no personal experience with it, but just interesting to look at it historically and see what was in place, and, you know, just because, I mean, I was reading a interview or watching an interview with Sid Meier, and it was either with Sid Meier or someone from Firaxis, but basically, when a new Civ game is developed, they try to do, like, a 33% ratio, like, 33%, like, new features, 33% returning features, and 33% like enhanced, like smoothing out features that need to be, like, fixed or whatever. So it's kind of interesting to, you know, just look at what is in common through the development of these games.
And I strongly feel like that is such a great model for really keeping
iterative
the series
game
alive.
Design.
Exactly. Iterative game design is exactly where I was going with this. It's just, I think it's such a good way to iterate on ideas, to keep the good stuff in circulation, and you know, cycle out some of the ideas that maybe didn't work. Anyway, I want to move on to Civilization 2. Civilization 2 is tricky for me because I only played the PlayStation port, and I didn't care for it a whole lot. That's probably due to playing the PlayStation port. The original release date of Civ 2 was February 29th, 1996.
Oh,
it released on the PlayStation in December of 1998. So, yeah. Apparently, in 2002, Atari actually re-released the game for newer operating systems like Windows 2000 and Windows XP. You know, it's still very similar game. This is where we ended up getting the isometric representation of the game screen, though, and that's something that still to this day is a part of the game.
Right, and I like the isometric map. I mean, I like isometric games as is, but I mean, you definitely can see, like, it looks a lot more immersive with your little Civ building up.
Indeed. We got the re-release of the game in 1997. Civilization II Multiplayer Gold Edition, which also bundled the expansion sets, Conflicts in Civilization, and Fantastic Worlds. Something cool about Fantastic Worlds is that it actually included some scenarios from other Microprose games like XCOM, Master of Orion, and Master of Magic, which I thought was some cool stuff. Conflicts in Civilization was specifically more focused on some like combat, like online type scenarios. It had 20 new scenarios, 12 of which were from the makers of the game, and 8 which were like online scenarios made by fans as like early mods.
Oh, wow.
It included like a whole new like macro language for scenario scripting for like user created content. So very cool stuff. And in a lot of ways, I feel like Civilization 2 is where you start to see sort of the current version of Civ a little more. When you look at sort of the Civilization 1 to Civilization 2, Civilization 2 just, it looks a little bit more like the game we play today, a little bit more of a focus on the individual units and the individual goings on of cities. So definitely some interesting stuff there. Civilization 3, though, I think is where a lot of us really jumped on board. This released in 2001, specifically October 30th, 2001. And this game was head and shoulders over the other two. Its graphics were beautiful. It by far, you had like the most control over like your individual tile improvements and like how you're going to work them to produce resources off of them, what your individual citizens are doing. It was just sort of, if Civilization 2 is where the Civ that we are familiar with was born, this was sort of where it started to take shape into the form that we are familiar with now. Civ 3 was received very positively. It won all kinds of Game of the Year awards back in the day. Of course, you know, it still wasn't quite where we want it to be in the modern day, I guess, but it did have two expansions, Play the World and Conquest. Play the World, of course, was the multiplayer add-on that by this point in the Civ game was like the expected first expansion. And Conquest was specifically about adding like historic-based scenarios with like new playable groups. Things that people really liked from these were stuff like the Mesoamerican campaign and the Sengoku Japan campaign. This version, or this expansion, was also included in the Civilization 3 Complete Edition, which is available on Steam for play even today.
Yeah, and I mean, even though, yes, it does look dated, I mean, it still looks pretty nice. I mean, and I can only imagine at the time, it probably looked pretty cutting edge.
Aw, dude, it really did. Now, Civilization 4 came a few years later. This was, of course, in 2005, specifically October 25th. We're still just looking at Windows and Mac OS. Civilization 4 is probably the first game in the series that I personally put like several hundred of hours into. The 4X game style at this point was like pretty heavily codified. Of course, that's what we call, you know, explore, expand, exploit, and exterminate. At this point, you know, it's a subgenre all of its own. We ended up with several expansions for Civilization. We had Civilization 4 Warlord, Civilization 4 Beyond the Sword, as well as the standalone expansion, Civilization Colonization, which is like a very micro-focused game. Rather than being focused on like the whole world, you're really focusing on just like conquering and colonizing the New World, coming from one of four European nations within the time window of 1492 to 1792. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a really interesting footnote and side game, and we start to see some side games from here. We're going to be talking about them in a minute. Probably not talking about Alpha Centauri today. You're welcome. But all in all, this game was beautiful. It really, what we think of as Civilization today is almost completely present in Civilization 4. We already have the isometric viewpoint. Combat units work the same as they do today, except back then you could stack your military units on the same tile. And as a result, you would end up with what now people refer to as like doom stacks, where you'd have like 10 military units on one tile. You move them all in one go, and basically you just have like one doom stack that can take down entire cities. It was a trip. It's such a different game from the game that we play today. I think the game we play today is a lot more balanced, certainly. Saiki, do you have any thoughts on Civ 4?
Yeah, I've spent, when I say a little bit of time, I mean maybe like less than an hour. When I, you know, started playing Civ 5, you know, of course there were Steam sales and stuff that it was like, oh, you know, get the rest of the Civ series for super cheap. So I was like, why not? And I mean, I could definitely appreciate, you know, that it's almost there in terms of like what I had been used to at that point with Civ 5. I mean, there's like the...
Oh, because you played going backward.
Right. And so, you know, a lot of what I like about Civ 5, you know, was already there in Civ 4. There was like, you know, the UN votes for world leader, espionage, religion. I honestly can't speak to if that was the first one, but like the Great People were also definitely in Civ 4. And like I said, I don't know if it was the first one, but I mean, it's really interesting to see just how much of it was there, especially because this is kind of like this game kind of goes on like a 5-year release cycle, you know?
Yeah.
So just to think that, you know, even, you know, at this point, 11 years ago, that the game had come so far in its first, 15 or so years, I know a lot of, from what I've seen, a lot of people still prefer Civ 4, honestly. Like,
yeah.
Really, like, fans of the older...
Even today.
...style of game, because Civ 5 was pretty controversial from what I gather from, you know, those who were in the Civ community for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, some really interesting stuff about Civ 4, of course, is that it was sort of their first step at, like, leaving the game very open to modification. Game data and rules were just stored in user-editable XML files. They released a free, like, software development kit pack in April of 2006 to allow customization of the game AI. And most of the game is just written in Python and is open, available for customization. It also came with, you know, like, a world builder that also, like, after you created a world, all of the game attributes were stored in XML files, so you could easily edit them as a user. Just really cool stuff. This game was also very well known and noted for its award-winning soundtrack, which was actually amazingly, the title music was influenced by The Lion King. Some local performers to us here at the studio actually created the song Baba Yetu, which is Swahili for Our Father, that actually won a 2011 Grammy Award.
That's interesting, because that's way after Civ 4 was released.
Yeah, but I think they're also on a weird year schedule as far as listing their year. Anyway, moving forward, just from that note, you know, we also saw a lot of bonus content get released in the form of, like, mods that the game devs saw and really dug and released, like, as, like, official, like, bonus content, which I thought was really cool. This was sort of, I feel like, where sort of the current model of technology, government, and religion sort of came into play. So if you're looking for, like, getting into Civ, this is where we start with the recommendations. I think that if you're interested in playing Civ, you're not super familiar with sort of the 4X model, I think that Civ 4 or Civ 5 are probably the best places to hop in. Psyche, what do you think about that?
Civ 4 and Civ 5?
As the entry point for people who are new to 4X gameplay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, 4 even more for historical context. And also, I just looked up why. It's because the composer, Christopher Tin, included Baba Yetu on his 2009 album. That's why it was so much later than the release of Civ 4.
Excellent. Well, let's move forward and talk about the first console spinoff. This is a game that was developed specifically for consoles. This is Sid Meier's Civilization Revolution. It was released for the PS3, 360, Nintendo DS, Windows Phone, and iOS. There was both a Wii version and a PlayStation Portable version in the works at one point, but they were both canceled for different reasons. Civ Rev is sort of a little bit of a different beast because it plays similar to, like, sort of quote-unquote real Civ, but the maps tend to be smaller, there's fewer mechanics to worry about, and fewer turns taking place within each game. Have you put any time into the Civ Rev series?
No, I feel like they took it off of the marketplace.
I don't believe they did, but...
Really?
Yeah, I don't believe so. Either way, though, in particular, you know, the iOS and DS versions are very scaled down. They're very cute little games, though. Particularly, I mean, literally, the art assets in them look cute, but, you know, they're still fun. The problem for me is that I'm not really interested in a scaled down Civ experience, but I actually work with several people who are really into the Civ Rev game. So if you're looking for a way to get into Civilization, that might be a window too. Just be aware that you are playing a scaled down version of the game. These released in the summer of 2008.
All right.
Slaggy, I know you've put a lot of hours into this one. I've myself put in something like 400 hours.
Why don't you
talk about Civ 5?
Yeah, I mean, I myself have put at least 150 hours. And I mean, for me, that's a lot of time.
So talk about it.
So Civ 5 was released in 2010, and you know, it's really it's addictive. I mean, so there are some changes that, you know, for me, it wasn't really a change that I noticed because I played Civ 5 first. Like, you can't stack unit the way you could in Civ 4. I believe that it has a lot more sophisticated AI from what I am familiar with. The way that Siege Warfare works, it's also different with cities able to kind of have their own attacking, like cities can be kind of like a unit themselves and have a defense and a little like ranged attack. It also introduced city-states, which allow you to kind of play like another diplomatic sort of game, and you can either like intimidate them or give them gifts or just kind of do different things like quests that, you know, oh, you cleared out a barbarian encampment and they would give a bonus influence to anyone who did such. And then with the Brave New World expansion, you were able to do the World Congress. And
what are city-states? You mentioned city-states, and I wanted to ask you for more information on that before we get too far from it.
City-states are little independent civilizations that, you know, they can't go and conquer... I mean, they can't go and establish new cities. They can conquer other ones with military units, but, you know, so city-states are, you know, if you think of an actual city-state, kind of like an independent entity. And so usually, like, in the game, they're kind of to give you some sort of bonus. Some will let you have access to their resources. Some will even spawn military units, which is really helpful, especially if you're focusing your development on other stuff.
Okay.
And like I said, with Brave New World, which was the first expansion, if the more city-states that you're allied with, you'll get more delegates in World Congress, which really changes the kind of diplomacy victory.
Oh, absolutely.
Another really cool thing that kind of developed over the release cycle of Civ 5 was culture, because culture kind of just... I'm trying to think back, because Brave New World and Gods and Kings changed the game so much that, like, there's a lot of elements and a lot of strat. Like, the culture strategy is, like, totally different.
Oh, yeah, it's like now a completely different game.
It was
game.
Just about, like, filling out culture trees, right? That's all that you had to do to win culture victory. If I remember, like, you just had to get the culture trees filled out.
Yeah.
But then Brave New World introduced the idea of tourism, and so you have these great works. And so there's just really so many different ways to win, and to the point where, honestly, doing the militaristic steal all the capitals of other civilizations. You know, if I think one of the least interesting ways to win.
Ooh, girl.
And I know Seawolf Jason does not agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people play the game militaristically. It's not really my bag personally, but it's not my favorite way to win. I do agree that it's the least interesting, because it's sort of just like a basic, like, mathematical game at that point, rather than actually working out, like, building your assets and you know, exploring the tech trees. It's just about,
right,
you know, pumping out the military units in greater number than your opponents, and that it's just less interesting to me.
And you know, it's so interesting because you mentioned with the earlier civs about scenarios. I never play scenarios. I either just play like a straight up Civ game, or, you know, honestly, most of those 100 plus hours have been late night multiplayer games.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, there's a reason why the one more turn is a meme. I think, was it Civ 4 that had no more turns?
Yeah.
Like that, it was a fake protest. It was like, no more turns. It was like the Civ Addicts Anonymous or something like that.
Civ Anonymous, yeah.
And so, I mean, isn't that so true? Because you're like, oh, well, I'm just about to get this new World Wonder, and I want to make sure that, you know, I get it in and it boosts up my score or, you know, my culture before, just so I can go to sleep knowing that I have that boost, you know, ahead. And I think, I mean, it's just so addictive.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's, in the interest of keeping the show rolling, let's move on to the next game. We want to talk incredibly briefly over, like, a handful of minutes, no, more like a handful of seconds, about Civilization World. This was, of course, the Sid Meier Civilization World, originally launched on Facebook as Civilization Network. It released in open beta on July 6th, 2011, and was shut down on May 29th, 2013. It was basically Civ reimagined as a mobile social type game. It was meant to be like a full Civ experience in a fully persistent environment. Unfortunately, that isn't quite how it worked out.
Oh, boo.
Yeah. Luckily, CivRev 2 released on the iOS, Android, and PlayStation Vita platforms. It is an expansion of the mobile versions of the Civilization Revolution games. I recall enjoying it. it quite a bit. You know, it was, again, it's very much in the style of Civ Rev, just with, you know, new options, new scenarios, new units and world leaders. It released in 2014 for iOS and Android, and in 2015 on PlayStation Vita.
I imagine it would be a fun Civ on the go.
Yeah, that was my experience with the iOS version. Apparently, actually, the Vita version released in North America on March 29th, 2016. So just year. That is as Civ Rev 2 Plus. So definitely something exciting. It was actually primarily marketed to the Japanese audience, it looks like.
That's cool.
Yeah. Not that surprised, considering it was a Vita release. We did have a PC spinoff in the Civilization series, Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth. In a lot of ways, this is sort of a callback to Alpha Centauri, by which I mean literally the developers of Civilization Beyond Earth began their development of Beyond Earth by going to the Wikipedia article on Alpha Centauri and, like, designing the web tree based on, or the tech tree based on that. So, you know, it's somewhat interesting. It had the standalone title, Sid Meier's Starships, which, like, had some interplay, where that's, like, very, like, micro-based. Starships is very micro-based on just, like, fleet-to-fleet combat of ships in the Beyond Earth setting. It's a very interesting experiment, but unfortunately, I think the gameplay didn't quite land for most of us.
Yeah.
It did have the expansion pack Rising Tide, which released in 2015, the core game released in 2014. With Rising Tide, the game sort of took shape a little bit better, but it still felt like I was playing Civ, like Space Civ, but with fewer options and mechanics. And part of the fun of Civ is how much there is going on. You know, it's a tall order to get into Civ, but once you're there, like, the fun is really, like, that feeling of, like, I am simultaneously managing all 11 of these different things, and I haven't blown myself up yet.
I think something else about Beyond Earth is that part of what I enjoy about Civ is, like, the historical element of it. So the fact that it was Beyond Earth and, you know, these alien worlds.
So you enjoy things like when you research a new wonder and you get the pop-up that, like, Flykick has developed...
The pyramids. Although you always get the damn pyramids.
Yeah.
You do.
It's true. I was going to argue, but you're right.
You always get the pyramids and the
terracotta
army.
You get, like,
army.
The Library of Alexandria or something. Like, you get super into that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, because I'm a history nerd, so I like the historical civilization build. For me, having, like, a new spacey thing with, like, you know, fakeness, I mean, I don't know, just it did.
Fiction, we call it.
Fiction, yes. For more of a fictional approach, I didn't connect with it.
That's fair, and I think a lot of the fandom felt the same way. Let's talk then about the current release, Civilization VI. This, of course, released for Windows and OS worldwide on October 21st, 2016. Of course, you know, most games do in the modern age release worldwide when they're on PC like this. I kind of love it, actually. Something interesting, you know, the development of Civilization VI was led primarily by the teams that developed the expansions of Civ 5, and as a result, Civ 6 sort of was introduced with the mechanics from the Civ 5 expansions baked in as a part of the base game.
Which I'm so glad for.
Of course, sort of the critical focus of their development was to avoid the idea of having, like, one key build that you have to take in order to win. This is something that obviously has been plaguing not just 4X strategy game design, but all strategy game design, including, like, real time, where you have people who, you know, have mathematically worked out, like, the correct way to play StarCraft, and all other ways are inferior to that. So I'm personally a big fan of this idea. I'd like to ask you, Slaggy, how do you think the design focus there on avoiding a preset path of improvements has worked for Civ 6?
Oh, I mean, I think that, like, what they did to the tech tree and the civics tree and kind of splitting up some of the, like things like poetry and stuff are now part of the civics tree instead of the tech tree. And so I think things like that kind of allow you to be a little more able to diversify yourself and not lock you into, oh, well, I'm trying to go for this type of victory, so I've got to do this. It kind of gives you, you know, more adaptability.
Yeah. Well, and another really interesting design choice they made, what they had called city unstacking, is that previous iterations, I totally said iterations and previous is one word, I'd said idiots. In previous iterations of the Civ series, when you had a city, any improvements you built within your city just counted on your city tile. So as long as you protected that one city tile, you had all of those benefits and bonuses. now, when you build a improvement in your city, you still have to allocate it to a tile within that city's borders, which obviously can be several tiles away. And what that does is sort of makes all of the land within your city's space more valuable and more important to defend and protect. How, in your opinion, has that design change gone, Slaggy?
I think I really enjoy it, because you determine, different districts and, different types of terrain will benefit different types of things,
improvements, as we call them.
Yeah, being near a mountain, I believe, helps with science, and it really feels like I have more of an impact in developing and growing my city, whereas, for the most part, it would be in Civ 5 to compare, you'd have something you would do your things in your city, but then you go and build some farms, and then you'd build some quarries and stuff, and there's still definitely farms and quarries and, different resource improvements, but I like that, it also, to balance it out, you don't need to have, as many farms, I feel like, to feed your city or your civilization, because you're focusing on other things, where am I going to put my university? Where am I going to put my barracks? And I think it's just, another thing is just really cute to see your little university pop up, and you can actually go and look at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something else that I really like, which is not related to the district, is that there are the Eureka moments, which are, if you discover a natural wonder of some type, you might get a bonus to a certain type of technology. Or if you have done this sort of technology, or you've discovered you've defeated a barbarians, it might give you a bonus for some type of technology or some type of civic tree thing. And I think that's really cool, and it kind of is I kind of got my boost in that, so I'm kind of it's interesting, and then that it can kind of influence, instead of having that predetermined path, I'm going to do culture victory, and I'm putting all of my, from turn one, I'm focusing all of my energy on the culture victory. I mean, to the point where in the multiplayer games that we've played so far, which unfortunately are not as many as I would wish, but...
Well, and the biggest problem with that, we talk about how much we love these games. I do love them. There's a reason why we have so many hours in them, and that's because the typical game of Civ, if you're really going to play with friends and you're going to play through a whole game, you're looking at a 7 or 8 hour commitment there.
But it goes, it does not
even
feel
like it's
fine.
And it flies by. Yeah, it's a pleasant 7 or 8 hours, but it's 7 or 8 hours.
Yeah, and that being said, I feel in Civ 5, I'd be playing, and typically it would be where you would be winning, but I feel it'd be very clear, and I was I guess I just gotta enjoy building up my little Civ and seeing the cute little units do stuff, but I feel the enhancements they made to the design of Civ 6 really allow it to be kind of more anyone's chance. I know you and me and Seawolf Jason were playing, and we were all doing pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something I really love about Civ 6, is it feels way better balanced to different styles of play.
I also love the policy cards that instead of having this is my type of, this is, I'm going to be a, what do we call the people who are
workers?
A dictator.
Oh,
being a dictator, that type of having that, or having a democracy or whatever, you kind of have these things that give you different bonuses, which are the civic cards, and I really enjoy that. And also, yeah, the little quality of life changes, that the workers make, and they're called builders now, they make tile improvements immediately, which definitely changes kind of the flow, because you'd have my worker's still making a farm, 5 turns left, now it just has a number of uses, and then once you've used that builder up, it's extended. So
yeah, I think that change is actually one of my favorites. I play a very worker heavy, or have traditionally played a very worker / builder heavy Civ. Typically by the time I have reached endgame in older Civs, every tile in my nation has been improved multiple times. So this change has actually completely changed the way I play and the way I think about my Civ, and that's something I actually really like, because I don't want the game to remain static. I'm happy with that 33% of kept stuff 33% new stuff. So I'm really into that change. I think it completely changes, especially in the early game, how you use your builders because they are such a finite resource.
Right. And I also just love that a lot of thought went into the visual aesthetic of Civ 6.
I think it's very pretty. I know a lot of people felt it was like too cartoony or whatever, but I think
it's
kind of
got like the softness to it. I almost would say it would be like almost kind of painting-like. And I mean,
oh, yeah.
Civ 5 is a beautiful-looking game.
Oh, yeah, but with like a very realistic styling.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Civ 6, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that it's specifically designed in the way it is to be a little bit easier on lower resource machines to run. You know, these games can be real beasts on your PC, with even high-end PCs lagging hard in the later game of Civ 5 unless you turn your settings down a bit. So, you know, because it's just doing so much, you know, hundreds of units for every player, these huge AI calculations for what their
mm-hmm.
entire empires are going to be doing in the off turn. So, Civ 6 apparently is actually a little easier on this. Designed to be streamlined enough to run on tablet PCs,
and
which obviously are a bigger part of the marketplace than they were when Civ 5 was developed.
And then, you know, just like with the Fog of War, which is like the undiscovered part, just being like a map, you know, like an undiscovered part
with,
of the map.
You know, like here be dragons and all that. It's just a really cute stylistic touch.
It is. And I think really, like I was talking about the idea that Sid Meier's idea of designing, you know, iterative game design is that 33-33-33 balance. Coming from Civ 5 to Civ 6, I definitely see that. And
absolutely.
I mean, there are still features that I'm sure will be coming in
expansions.
But I mean, I think as a core release, there's so much going on that totally makes it. I mean, this would be my pick for the Civ to play.
Well, and so my thing is, I agree in terms of games, I think Civ is the most interesting. I don't think it's the most welcoming to new players. I would actually give that to probably Civ 5, maybe 4, but probably 5. I think 5 had the most useful, like, when you play for your first time and you say, like, I'm new to Civ, I need my pop-up, info pop-ups. I think Civ 5 is the one that did the most
for bringing
you into play.
Some listener feedback about that.
And that's actually why I'm calling it out, because I do think that if you're new to Civ, I think Civ 6 is the hardest of the modern Civs to get into. I think Civ 4 and 5 would both be easier if you don't have that bedrock foundation of understanding.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, definitely with Gods and Kings and Brave New World.
Civ 5 for me is probably the best entry point for understanding modern Civ.
Yeah, but I mean, definitely for core game, I think that this is the strongest core release.
Oh, I agree. You know, even the way that they, like, reworked the AI so that each AI player is now guided by, like, two main principles, one which you can typically see, and the other which is, like, a semi-randomized, like, hidden agenda that you have to sort of train your spies and diplomats to learn these hidden agendas. You know, I think that's a really cool game design choice that gives context to some of the things that in Civ 4 and 5 were just kind of happening.
Yeah.
So, yeah, big fans of the games, though. I think the Civilization series is fantastic. Unfortunately, we're sort of running longer than I thought we would, so we need to wrap this up.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you a couple of closing thoughts. First off, Slaggy, what do you get out of Civ as a fan of the series?
For me, it's all about the multiplayer. It's a fun multiplayer experience with friends, a friendly sort of competitive experience, not unlike, the times that Seawolf Jason and Captain Spike and I get together and play board games and such, you know, except it's, you know, it's a video game.
And another thing I really love about playing this game multiplayer, especially at LAN parties, we LAN this game a lot, is being able to just say, like, hey, how do I do blank? I think is a very helpful resource to, you know, especially if you're playing with friends who aren't dick, being able to be like, okay, I have this city here, but my production on stone is very low. How do I get more stone? And the answer to which, unfortunately, is typically like either find someone who has spare stone and trade for it, or found a new city near some stone.
Right, and I mean, that helped.
But you wouldn't know that if you didn't have a room of people to ask, because
I mean,
it's not something the game's necessarily going to communicate.
That helped me a lot with Civ 5, because the earliest days I would play it a lot. I mean, we do a buoy and then we'd be playing Civ until like 4 in the morning.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, that's a really, because for the most part, like, you know, I mean, really depends on who you play with, but I mean, you for the most part have been pretty fair, except when there's been cases where you've really wanted something and I wouldn't let you, and then you've attacked me, which is another thing, like, because there's just so much unpredictability when you play multiplayer that, you know, if you're playing with a friend who is power hungry, if you with Jason, and you're trying to attack all your cities, and this, like, the, oh, well, I'll help you out if you, you know, help protect me from Seawolf Jason, who's getting very close to my borders. So it's just, but like, I never get mad about it, even when I know that I'm not going to win, because for me, the fun of it is seeing my civilization grow, and, like, you know, even though I might be Catherine the Great or whatever, like, I take ownership of it, and, you know, it's my civilization that I help build up, and, you know, even if it's not perfect. Something that was really made me mad about the initial release of Civ 6, which apparently has been patched in since, is that originally, upon first release of Civ 6, you cannot rename your cities, and so...
So you couldn't have your city of, like, Tiggle Bitties?
Mm-hmm.
Or Fartsville?
I like to think I'm a little more creative than that, but...
You're not.
Anyway...
Those are both real cities you've made.
Anyway, you know, especially when you get to name your cities, I know that's a very minor thing, but, I mean, that's just always been part of the fun, and, like, you know, religion, you know, like I said, like, you shape the civilization to be what you want it, so there is that element of the, like, you know, historical part of it, but also, you know, you could be France and have the pyramids, like, it's whatever, so it's just, it's a historical, it's a mix of history and fantasy and strategy, and I love it.
Excellent. All right, what are your thoughts on the current release of the series, and to the degree that you haven't already stated, that is?
Right. I mean, I think that it is a really polished experience. Like you said, maybe not the most newcomer friendly, but I mean, I guess at this point I had to realize that I'm not a newcomer to Civ, so I'm really happy. You know, I was a little worried based on Beyond Earth. I was like, oh, maybe Civ 6 is a long way off. So the fact that we got it this year and that it's already such a great game, I mean, if we weren't going to a concert tonight, I'd be like, let's play some Civ 6.
If we weren't going to a concert tonight, I would say, yeah, let's play Civ 6. All right, well, so what are your thoughts on Civ's current state as a franchise? And you kind of already addressed that, but if you have anything additional to say.
Yeah, I mean, 25 years and, you know, better than ever, you know, it's definitely, and, you know, it's a game that is so well-received and, you know, pretty universally acclaimed that I'm not worried about it going anywhere, especially, you know, so I would say that, you know, definitely Civ 6 has renewed my confidence in the franchise. Not that it was entirely shaken, but, you know, Civ Beyond Earth was a little bit of a rough spot.
Really was a rough spot. All right, where would you suggest newcomers jump in? I think you already addressed that.
Yeah, I mean, if you're more familiar with strategy games, you might be able to jump into Civ 6, or, you know, maybe returning to the series if you haven't, if you were turned off by Civ 5, I definitely say come back. But, you know, Civ 5 still, especially with its expansions,
which you can get during Steam sales, you can get the complete version for, like, under $10 now.
Yeah, I mean, with the expansions, I would definitely say Civ 5 would be a great place to jump in, especially if you pick it up on a Steam sale, like you said, you're not sure if you want to drop the full price for Civ 6 yet, you know, definitely worth it, and let us know if you do, because we will play Civ games with you, even if it's 5.
Excellent. All right. Well, with all that having been said, let's move on and talk about what's going on.
I said, hey, what's going on?
All right, so this week I have been playing Pokemon Sun and Moon. I finished Pokemon Moon.
All right.
Put a little bit more time into my Japanese Pokemon Sun playthrough. I also played some Final Fantasy 15, by which I mean I finally beat it.
Oh.
My opinions of Final Fantasy 15 are actually higher than they were when we recorded our last episode. Obviously, Chapter 13, not something I loved or enjoyed, but the ending of the game for me was a perfect 10, and so ultimately I came away from the game, still incredibly positive. I do think Chapter 13 should have been literally half as long as it was, but I think the tweaks that they're making to the game via patch for Chapter 13 will make it more palatable. But overall, incredible game. I think it's fantastic. I do understand people's criticisms of it when I see them online, but I just don't agree with them. And the other big one, and this is funny, is Super Mario Run, which I've already put more than 5 hours into, despite it only going live a day or two ago and being a phone game. It is absolutely a real 2D Mario game. The automatic running is incidental. It's designed so well. It's designed just like a real Mario game, but with the concessions for the platform baked into the game design, so that, to me at least, it never felt artificial. It never felt like, you know, some auto runner try hard game. It just feels like a Super Mario game in which you happen to be auto running. It is closer to like the 2D auto run stages in New Super Mario Bros. 2, like the canon stages, than it is to something like Cannabalt or Sonic Runners or something. I've actually seen a lot of people online, I don't normally come for people like this, but I've seen a lot of people online say that like Super Mario Run is overpriced at $10 because, you know, it's basically just an endless runner. This game has been done hundreds of times before, and you can get, you know, alternatives for free on the App Store. I completely disagree. Super Mario Run, it keeps all of the hallmarks of 2D Mario game design. It keeps those Super Mario physics that are, to me, so important to what makes Super Mario work as a platform game. You know, the exact weight of the jumps, the exact momentum of a running Mario, the height that you bounce off of your enemies and bounce higher off of them if you're holding jump. All of these things are baked into the game exactly the way you would expect them to if you've been playing the series since Mario Bros. 3. It is absolutely a real Mario game. I am beyond impressed and delighted and enjoying it as much as I would a new 2D Mario game as a result. So
that's great.
I'm a huge fan. If you can't tell by how I'm ranting and raving, I'm enjoying it so much. And I wholeheartedly recommend everyone who has an iOS device, because it's not on Android yet, download it. At least play the first three free stages. And don't play through them once and give up. You know, typically since like the Super Mario World era, is it? You know, we have like the Yoshi coins and Dragon coins hidden in stages. Mario Run is based on that concept. Each stage has three sets of hidden coins, and you can only get one set of them per run, sort of in the style of Super Mario 64. And when you're set up to get a set of coins, be it the pink coins or the green coins, or I'm sorry, not green, purple, or the black coins, the stage design actually changes, very similar to Mario 64. So, you know, platforms may or may not be there depending on what version of the level you're running. And so it adds really interesting twists to your understandings of the level and how you have to approach them if you want to get all of these coins. And so to me, playing the game and getting all of the coins from all of the variations of the level makes it a very fun game. And it takes that sort of core, like, 48 stage number, because I've seen a lot of people like, well, it's only 48 stages, it's an endless runner, it's not worth all that. But, like, if you consider all of the iterations of the stages, there's actually, like, a considerable amount of content on display here. So, yeah, I'm overwhelmed. I was not expecting Nintendo to hit it out of the park like they did on their first real mobile game. It is, to me, an absolute home run. And when I start talking about this as a Game of the Year contender, I know people are going to LOL, but I have never played a mobile phone game the way I'm playing this one. It's probably the first time that, like, this week I've played more Super Mario Run since Thursday than I played Pokemon Moon all week. So,
wow.
Yeah, every time I'm on the train, it's like, yes, Mario Run time. Every time I have a lunch break at work, yes, Mario Run time. I cannot get enough of it.
That's awesome.
What about you? What have you been playing?
I've been picking away a little at Final Fantasy 15, trying to remain spoiler free. Very, very lightly trying to get back into WoW, but also feeling the siren's call of Final Fantasy 14.
Ooh, I feel that, girl.
And something else that we were both playing was the Rock Band Rivals content.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really cute. It's done in the style of VH1 Behind the Music.
The rockumentary.
And it's just, it's really funny. Like, you know, I didn't think it was going to be much, but it actually is a nice way of building on the kind of a, you know, RPG sort of mode that came with Core Rock Band 4. So definitely a lot of fun, you know, and a lot of laughs. Very funny.
Excellent.
All right, with that, we got some quick social links to rattle off to you. First, we like to get to our question of the week. This week, we celebrate 25 years of Sid Meier's Civilization. What are your experiences with the 4X that has been a hit 6X or 6 times? Bill B over on Facebook says, I've been playing Civilization since 1993, late start, I know, on our first Mac. Fondest memory of it was the copy protection method, which we skirted around by the person who gave us the game, had printed out screenshots of the entire Civilopedia, so we'd have all the answers. If you don't recall, the game would ask you what the precursor to a certain tech was in the tech tree every 50 turns. I feel some guilt towards having stolen the game, but things were kind of different back then, I think. I feel like I've made up for it by being a loyal supporter and playing every iteration since then, except Beyond Earth, but I won't go into that one.
Ah, right.
Your Enzyme saying, I've never spent a lot of time with Civ games, but recently got Civ 6. I wish it had some kind of tutorial. I hear such great things about it, but then get so lost so quickly. It's frustrating. Frowny face. Even picking the I never played a Civ game option, it doesn't really tell you how, why, or what to do for anything. And yeah, that's what made me rethink recommending Civ 6 as the, you know, starting point. But, you know, Your Enzyme or anyone out there, if you want to hop in Civ 5 or Civ 6, or hell, I guess even Civ 4 if you want to, you know, you can just hit us up on Twitter. Speaking of tweets, we have a couple more to catch up on. We had our Final Fantasy 15 episode, and Your Enzyme said, can't wait to give it a listen. We have a animated GIF of Harley from Digital Devil Saga saying, yarr! And it was retweeted by Steve Pixel saying, I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me is always his first mate, Slackkick. Very cute. Emiru69 saying, I was eating food in the morning, hashtag FFXV, I was eating food in the morning. In the last episode of GameBuoy.org, they said eat before resting. I'm not sure I get it. So I think what we meant is that, you know, at the campsites is when Prompto can cook for you, but you can also eat at the diner. So I'm guessing that maybe that is what Emiru meant by eating in the morning, but let us know. We have a tweet from Your Enzyme saying Lost Odyssey is free for a short period of time. So glad that Your Enzyme also was on that tip of the free Lost Odyssey, which I need to go do that. And as soon as I'm back at my place, get that downloading.
Heck yeah.
With that, I believe that does it this week for our social media. As ever and always, we love your feedback. We love your iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. We like your Facebook likes, and we effing love Twitter. Our Twitter is GameBuoy.org with the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
GameBuoy.org.
With the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
D-O-T-O-R-G.
And our email is mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
And our home base is GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
But you can hear us first streaming on where, Spike?
The Voice of Geeks Network over at VogNetwork.com, where you can also hear such shows as Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO, Orange Arms Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom we steal so many of our cues. The Ranger Pridecast, where myself and Shane Alenko talk about the current season of the Power Rangers meta series, as well as the current season of the Super Sentai meta series upon which it's based. And last but definitely not least, the Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. And in non-VOG shows, you should also check out the Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin, and X Nation, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. Slaggy, take us a place.
I'm going to take you to a game bar. Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Home Companion and a part of the Hunty Bunch, along with VG Realness, serving up a dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, La Palanca Podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español, the Joystick Jockeys, two LGBTQ gamers who love games and love talking about them, and our allies over at the Nintendo Fun Club, your place for platformers, positivity, and pop-punk. I'd also like to shout out to our sister ship, Anime Buoy, your port of call for anime recommendations, news bits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. We're definitely looking forward to getting some more anime buoys out there in the sea.
Yeah, we would have recorded a Escaflowne episode this weekend, but I had a really bad cough that only resolved today.
Yeah.
So it just was not feasible for me to record this week. I'm really sorry, guys.
And our latest podcast pirate venture is Dabcast.org, which is the same type attack bonus podcast, which is your twice monthly look into the deeper worlds of Pokemon with the two of us and Trainer Sulker as well.
We also would have had a new episode of that out this weekend.
But he's in Alola.
But Trainer Sulker is in real-life Alola, and with my cough and everything, it just wasn't in the cards. We will be back at you next week.
Indeed. And our wonderful theme music was done by the late, great Zelda Reorchestrated, the project that aimed to reorchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. They unfortunately closed their doors quite a while back, but we'll forever be pouring out a 40 for them in the Great Fairy Fountain.
All right, with all of that having been said, thank you so much for tuning in tonight and spending this lovely Sunday evening with us. We really appreciate your time and attention. I hope you've had half as much fun listening as we've had talking. We're very much looking forward to getting back to you in a couple of weeks with our end of year thought. But until then, keep gaming, keep thinking, and
the beating of a million drums! Gandhi has denounced you.
Mic check, mic check, mic check, mic check.